Oh, hi there, and welcome to our June Patreon wrap-up. What is this? What on earth am I talking about? Well, if you don't know what our Patreon is, it is basically a membership platform that allows us to create our very own subscription service. So if you head on over there, you can choose however much money you want to subscribe to Red Handed for, and then in return, you get more and more content. So the more you give, the more you get. It's really simple. And so, because we generate so much content over there on a weekly basis, we decided it was only fair if we made the rest of you aware of exactly what was going on. So every single month, we put together a very quick wrap-up of some of the highlights from our Patreon content. And that is this for the month of June. So enjoy, and I'll see you on the other side.
On the 13th of March, 1996, at 9:30 a.m., 47-year-old Mrs. Gwen Mayer, a teacher at Dunblane Primary School in Scotland, ushered her class of 28 five-year-olds out of the assembly hall and into the gymnasium for their morning PE lesson. The children were already changed into their PE kits and gathered in the middle of the large room, whilst Mrs. Mayer chatted with two other members of staff. The sounds of children playing were silenced immediately when two loud bangs suddenly rang through the air. Everybody spun around in the direction of the noise, and that's when they saw a man dressed in a dark coat, black corduroy trousers, and a woolly hat with ear defenders walk into the gymnasium. In his hand was a gun. Over the next few minutes, this man carried out one of the most heinous crimes ever committed in the UK, and his name was Thomas Hamilton.
Hamilton was born in Glasgow on the 10th of May 1952 to Thomas Watt and Agnes Hamilton. Another Agnes, mother of a messed up individual.
Yes, yeah, I noticed that. I was reading through that this morning. Maybe there should be a No Agnes's club.
Maybe there should be. If you don't know what we're talking about, you haven't listened to the Jimmy Savile episode, so I know it's disgusting, but please go do that. So yes, another Agnes mum here. He's born to Thomas and Agnes, but the couple separated shortly after Thomas's birth. And by 1955, they were officially divorced. After this, Agnes found herself penniless, and along with her son, she moved back in with her aunt and uncle in Cranhill, Glasgow. Only Agnes referred to James and Catherine, her aunt and uncle, as mum and dad, because they had actually adopted Agnes. And they did this because at the time, appearances were, of course, everything, and Agnes had been born out of wedlock. And this theme of, like, baby adoption out of shame repeated itself again, because now, with Agnes turning up there with baby Thomas in her arms, James and Catherine ended up adopting Agnes's son as well on the 26th of March 1956. In fact, they were so concerned about saving face that Catherine, Agnes's aunt mum, went to such great lengths to fake her own pregnancy, things like, you know, strapping on a fake fucking baby bump. And this was also that everyone in the community believed that Thomas was actually her biological son. And this is the foundation of the extremely repressed childhood of Thomas Hamilton. And interestingly, of course, many of you may recognise that particular theme occurring because it's just like our least favourite murder prick, Bundy. Because, of course, Thomas grew up in that household believing that Agnes, his biological mother, was his sister, and that his great aunt and uncle were his parents.
James and Catherine were strict disciplinarians who raised Thomas to be extremely conscious about how others perceived him. Catherine in particular was very controlling and has been described by the press as, quote, the mother from hell. People in the community could see something was very odd about the family, and rumours began to spread. And so, wanting a fresh start away from the whispers, they moved to Stirling, which is about an hour away from Glasgow. But no matter where they went, it was still glaringly obvious that two elderly parents and a 21-year age gap between two supposed siblings didn't add up. So soon, whispers began around Stirling as well. Maybe because of raised eyebrows, Hamilton's time at school followed suit with his difficult home life. He was isolated from the rest of his peers and never formed any true friendships. To put it nicely, Hamilton was a total failure socially.
And I know this is a jumping back a bit, but the press like constantly refer to Catherine's So Thomas's adoptive mother as the mother from hell. But like, we've seen way worse.
I was also going to say that. Like I think she's, you know, very much a product of her time.
Yeah, it's the 50s.
But I think she is trying to do the right thing.
She's trying to do, I think, what she thinks is the right thing.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
It's very strange that contemporary, like, newspapers at the time would have called her the mother from hell for, like, pretending that this baby was hers. Like, I felt like that would have not been that weird to people. But yeah, strange.
Yeah.
Psychologists have characterized Hamilton's early teen years as when he began displaying schizoid personality traits, which include, for those of you who don't know, we've talked about schizoid personality before on this show, but just for a very quick rundown of some of the typical traits you see if one does have that personality disorder, is usually being indifferent to other human beings, not enjoying or even really seeking out close relationships, an inability to experience pleasure, a difficulty in expressing emotions. They're kind of your typical bread and butter.
Yeah, it's a bit of like a Dennis Nilsson.
Yeah, just like a bit of a step back from the rest of society, personality-wise. Mm. And it's likely because of these traits, because Hamilton must have been showing some of these for him to have been assessed as having this. I think Hamilton just really embraced his isolation. So when we talk about him being a failure socially, I don't think Hamilton altogether minded that much. That's the thing. And although he was a fairly gifted student, Hamilton decided to leave school in 1968, at the age of just 15, to start an apprenticeship at the county architect's office. But he found his real passion, however, in the Scouts, which is not what I was expecting to read about when we started this case. I didn't know that much about this case, but I was like, oh. But then I guess, like, maybe, like, wasn't BTK a bit scouty something?
I think plenty of them are a bit scouty. I think it's, you know, because you've got power over younger people and everyone listens to you. And, well, in theory, it's also quite a manly thing to be doing. Mm-hmm. So if you feel emasculated, you're just going to like hang out in the woods, tie some knots, burn some stuff, you know?
That's true. And also, again, I'm showing my ignorance is we're obviously going to see that retrospectively, Hamilton wanting to be a scout leader makes the most sense because he's like, he's into kids, mm-hmm. like, let's just say that. But showing my ignorance in the sense that I didn't realize that the Dunblane massacre was really anything to do with that. I thought it was kind of like just a random Sandy Hook kind of situation.
Yeah, I was completely ignorant, to be honest. I had no idea.
No, none. So, yes, he loves the Scouts, does Hamilton. And by 1973, he was actually second in command of Stirling's Boy Scout troop as a venture scout, whatever that means.
I don't know. It might be like super scout. I don't know. I should have asked my brother. He's a scout.
Oh. So initially, it was the structure and the organization of the Scouts that seemed to appeal to Hamilton, along with, of course, as Hannah said, the feelings of dominance and control that his position gave him. And by the time he was 21, Hamilton was made the leader of the 24th Stirlingshire Scouts.
Psychologists have pinned his commitment to the Scouts to a number of psychological needs. Firstly, it served almost as the stable family life that he'd never had when he was growing up, and everything was seemingly going well, until Catherine, his great-aunt and adoptive mother, revealed to Hamilton, now 22, that his sister, Agnes, was actually his biological mother.
Why would you tell him? Why?
Well, I don't know. I think that possibly these days having an open narrative with adopted children is very common. Mm-hmm. But I think probably back then, like even if it wasn't like a sister mother situation, yeah. I think it was I could be completely making this up, but I think people finding out as adults that they are adopted in the olden times was a lot more common than it is now. I think now it's a lot more people choose to have like an open narrative with their child, mm-hmm. of being like, you are adopted, but it doesn't mean we don't love you, you know? Whereas I guess they probably thought he was going to find out eventually. Maybe they were sick of lying to him. I don't know.
Maybe it's like, you know, he's born in the 50s and they hide it all up. And then by the time he's 22, they're in the swinging 70s. And they're like, hey, let's just tell you. Hey, kid, guess what?
Yeah.
Your sister's your mum. Apparently, the same thing happened to Jack Nicholson.
Yes, it did. Yes, yeah. It did. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he's fine, kind of.
Seems fine.
I don't know if something similar happened to Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey seems like something like that has happened to him.
I would be more surprised if I found out it hadn't happened to Jim Carrey.
Right, yes, yeah. So now the family secret was out. Hamilton was probably overwhelmed by feelings of betrayal and humiliation. Not to mention the pain of learning that Agnes, who he thought was his sister, had willingly gone along with the lie his whole life, even though she should have been the one person who loved him the most. Maybe he thought she couldn't have loved
him. Okay, would you like an update from last month in the news?
Yes. Oh, I think I know what it is, but yes.
Yes, 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 yes. You do know what it is. So, well. So last month in our topical segment in the news, which is available to all of you, actually, all patrons. And in that, we were talking about the case of a Greek helicopter pilot and his British wife who lived in Greece, and how one day there was a home invasion at their house, and the wife, Caroline Crouch, was murdered by said invaders. They also had a baby daughter in the house, but she was fine. The husband was fine. Well, little plot twist of horror here for you, because Babis, the husband who survived, well, surprise, surprise, he did it. He has now admitted to killing Caroline after claiming that robbers had murdered her. So basically, it's now believed that he killed Caroline. I'll talk about how and why and all of that. And then he called the police because he had to fake the scene. Because I think he killed her in like a spur of the moment situation. And then he was like, now I have to cover it up. I'm going to come up with this elaborate ruse that we had fucking a home invasion and she was murdered. To pull this off, you guys will remember from that episode that the dog was also dead and tied to the fence outside. He strangled their 7-month-old husky puppy and tied it by its own leash to the fence to solidify his story. I mean, this guy is one fucking sick fuck. So basically, this happened about 5 years ago that Caroline, 5 weeks ago, sorry, that Caroline was murdered. And after she was killed, Babis was going regularly on TV begging people to come forward with any information they had about these men who had broken into their house and killed his wife and terrorized his daughter and him. But his confession came last Wednesday in a very satisfying moment, because apparently he was at Caroline's memorial service, crying and sobbing and hugging Caroline's mother. This fucking sick fuck. Caroline's also British. Did I mention that? Probably. He's hugging his mother-in-law. And the police just turn up and fucking arrest this fuckhead. And they take him to the police station. And he confesses within like hours because he's such a little bitch. Not that you shouldn't confess if you've done it and that makes you a bitch, but he is a bitch. And basically the police had apparently always been suspicious of him because they were like, his story doesn't really add up and all of this. But they found out in some really interesting ways. Firstly, they found Caroline's diary entries, and in that she had written how she had actually wanted to leave him in July 2020, so almost a year ago, when their baby had just been born, because she said that there was just like she's writing about like a lot of domestic abuse, daily arguments, this kind of thing. But she says she changed her mind after he convinced her not to, because she didn't want her child to grow up without both of the parents. So she stays to try and work it out. But there are just so many of these saying that he would regularly break down the doors in the house to get to her and hit her and all of this kind of thing. And on the day that Caroline died, the police found that on her phone, she had been in the process of booking a hotel room for her and her baby only. Suspicious, right? Then they found a bunch of texts between her and Babis's phone. That's the husband. I'm only calling him his nickname because I can't pronounce his whole first name. I hate that I'm calling him this. Let's just call him the husband from now on. And they were in the same house together, but they were text arguing with each other. So one of them is upstairs, one of them is downstairs. The police find all of this. And basically, what seems to have happened is that at one point, Caroline calls him stupid. Calls the husband stupid. And this is when he seems to lose it because there are no texts after that. But what happens after is almost immediately after. And this is actually why maybe I take it back that he did it in the spur of the moment, because what he does is he disabled the home's surveillance camera. And the police can see this because it's obviously electronic. They can see at what time it's been disabled. Then he takes the memory card out of the surveillance camera and flushes it down the toilet. I'm not actually clear whether he does this before or after he kills her. It looks like he does it before, because then the news report says he then ran upstairs to the attic where Caroline was sleeping, got into a heated argument with her, pushed her onto the bed, and then smothered her to death with a pillow. So yeah, actually the timeline is that he disables the home security system, the surveillance stuff, flushes the memory card down the toilet, and then goes and kills Caroline. This is where it gets interesting. How the police know that there were no invaders is because then he's got a dead body. He then stages the scene. He kills the puppy, does all of that, and then waits a while before calling the neighbor for help to call the police. What the police discover is at 4:01 a.m., long before he says the invaders are in the house, Caroline was wearing like a Fitbit or an Apple Watch, some sort of fitness tracking watch. There was an intense burst of heart activity, clearly when he's attacking her. And then this goes on for 10 minutes, and then Caroline's heart stops at 4:11 a.m. But when they find her body, her watch is still on her wrist. So that is the window within which she dies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then you remember from last month's In the News episode that Babis says that when Caroline was being tortured or being like, you know, yelled at by these invaders, that he had been tied up and left in another room and that he couldn't move. During that time that he says he couldn't move, after Caroline's heart has stopped, she's still wearing the watch. He's also wearing his fucking Fitbit or Apple Watch or fitness tracker. And the police detect that the entire time he said that he was tied up, unable to move or call for help, he was fucking pacing around the house. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I briefly read about it this morning, and I think this is quite a Greek thing, but his picture is on her grave, like an actual photograph of him, and it is up now being removed.
Yeah.
But imagine like burying your wife with a picture of your face on her gravestone and you fucking murdered her. Like, that is another level of fucking I don't know what. Like,
whoa. Jesus Christ. But yeah, I just thought it's obviously horrific and like maybe not that shocking to some people that the husband did it. It seems like the police suspected him all along. But I just thought it was quite interesting how the fitness apps had been the real thing to prove her time of death so specifically.
My Fitbit is arriving today.
Oh, get you. Yoga, Connor,
Fitbit. Fitness journey.
So this month, and that is June 2021, a trial began involving the lottery, the devil, and human sacrifice. The events surrounding this trial took place in Wembley in northwest London, and we're talking about London, UK this time, in June of last year. Danielle Hussein, who lived with his grandmother and was a pupil at a school in Blackheath, which is in southeast London, had dreams of fame, power, and above all else, money. In his pursuit of those things, Danielle had come to the conclusion that the best way to achieve them was by signing a contract with a demon that led him to winning the National Lottery Mega Millions Super Jackpot. How very Faustian of him. He's like, the only way this is all going to happen for me is not through hard work and dedication and education and getting myself a good job and just knuckling down. It's going to be a pact with the devil that will allow me to win the fucking Mega Millions Super Jackpot.
Well, you know,
the devil works in mysterious ways.
Yeah, and you know, diligent hard work is one thing, but it does involve diligent hard work.
Overrated.
Yeah. And it's not going to be Mega Millions, is it?
It's overrated. It's also no guarantee.
Well, exactly.
You could work your ass off like a fucking twat your entire life and end up with no money whatsoever.
Yeah. The devil, on the other hand, gets results.
Surefire.
Just look at Lady Gaga.
Precisely. And this demon devil thing wasn't just like, you know, we'll just have a casual gentleman's agreement. No, no, no. Danielle and the devil decided on a contract. None of this is made up. This is all 100% factual news. This contract read, agreement for the mighty king Lucifuge Rothelkale. I will perform a minimum of 6 sacrifices every 6 months for as long as I am free and physically capable. And here are the bullet points underneath. He agrees to sacrifice only women, to build a temple for this demon, and to do everything that I have promised. And underneath were the words, for me, And then it said, win the Mega Million Super Jackpot. To receive fruitful rewards in return for the future sacrifices I make to you, the rewards would consist of wealth and power, and to never be suspected of any crimes by the police, and also that the police will never know of any crimes that I have done and will do.
Mm-hmm.
And then Danielle signed his name, in blood, of course, beneath, folded the contract, and then placed 3 lottery tickets inside. That is some work that is happening.
It is, but is it that much for the Mega Million Super Jackpot? Not really. Apart from the women he intends to kill, obviously.
No, because all he says is, I'll perform a minimum of 6 sacrifices of 6 women every 6 months. 666, I get it, for as long as he's free and capable. All he's asking for in return is to win the Mega Million Super Jackpot and never be suspected of any crimes ever by the police. Fucking hell.
I'm really interested to see what happens. I haven't read this one yet. So I want to know how he gets his gothic horror comeuppance.
Oh, well, let me tell you. So according to Wikipedia, Lucifuge Rofocale is the demon in charge of Hell's government and treasury by order of Lucifer. This guy's done his research. You don't just go to fucking Payman, the solemn, what is it? The king of the smaller keys, the lesser keys. What is it? I don't know.
Oh, the Lesser Key of Solomon is like a book of demons that like lists them.
I see.
But yeah, payment wouldn't help you with money. Lucifuge is definitely the Mr. Moneybags, the Scrooge McDuck of the demon world, if you will.
Exactly. He's in charge of the treasury. He's the Rishi Sunak of hell. So he goes to the right person. If you don't know who Rishi Sunak is, he is the Chancellor of the Exchequer here in the UK. And this is what Danielle obviously believes Lucifuge to be. But of course, as far as we're concerned, he's most likely not really any of those things, but you know, whatever. So in order to carry out his plan, Danielle went to an Asda in southeast London, where he picked up a 13-inch kitchen knife and 3 lottery tickets. We'll come back to Danielle and Lucifuge in just a moment, because first we need to talk about 2 women, Bieber Henry and her sister, Nicole Smallman. Bieber was a social worker working for Buckinghamshire Council. She loved her job and took great pride in supporting families from lower economic backgrounds, encouraging them to pursue their passions despite their tougher start in life. Her sister Nicole lived in Harrow and was a freelance photographer. She was good at what she did and had worked her way up through the industry after graduating from Westminster University. Bieber was celebrating her 46th birthday with Nicole and her friends in Frayant Country Park in northwest London on June the 6th, 2020. Important to note that at this point, Nicole is 27. The group was seen on CCTV on their way to the park, listening to music and dancing. When they arrived, the celebrations went on late into the night, and after a few hours had passed, the group dispersed and went home. But Bieber and Nicole had enjoyed the celebration so much that they decided to stay on in the park after their friends had left. So for context, obviously June 2020, hot. It was actually a pretty good summer last year.
Yeah, it was.
But obviously we were in COVID. We were in COVID by this point. And so that's why they're hanging out in the park. That's probably why people were going home. Was there a curfew at this point? Possibly. I can't remember.
I think it was June, like March to May was like hard lockdown. And then I think June, you were allowed to sit down because the big rule was you couldn't sit down outside. That was the thing. And I think when June rolled around, you were allowed to sit in parks. So that would have been like just the sort of lifting.
The lifting time. Yeah. So it makes sense that people are out, but then they're quite quickly heading home, but the two sisters stay. They lit fairy lights, listened to music, and continued to dance. By this point, they've possibly also not seen each other for months, so that's probably why they're trying to maximise the time together. And a few hours later, the sisters decided to take some pictures of themselves, and several photographs were taken on their phone in a burst. And this is when you set your phone to take multiple pictures, so loads of them in quick succession, so just like seconds apart. But in the last picture of their final burst, the sisters can be seen looking off to their left as if distracted by something. I hate this. I hate the kind of cases where there's like photographs of the victim just before something horrible has happened. But what we do know now is that that distraction that had made the sisters look off to the left was Danielle Hussein. Danielle pounced on the women from behind the bushes, brandishing a blade and savagely attacking them. Bieber was taken totally by surprise, and he grabbed and stabbed her 3 times in the heart and 2 in the lungs. Nicole tried to fight him off, causing a deep cut to his hands in the process. But Danielle was able to overpower her, and he turned the knife on Nicole, stabbing her 28 times. Once the sisters had been brutally murdered, Danielle dragged their bodies across the grass and hid them in a hedge. Bodies concealed, he left, feeling sure that he was in for a big lotto payout and no repercussions thanks to his deal with the devil. Jesus Christ, what the fuck? Like, they're just hanging out in a fucking park.
Yeah.
And then this fucking maniac stabs him to death because he thinks he's going to win the lottery because of it.
Speaking of Jesus Christ, do you know who Bieber and Nicole's mum is?
No, I don't. I don't remember.
She's an Anglican bishop. She's really high up in the Anglican church.
Oh, shit. Oh, God. I did not know that. Or I did know that and I've forgotten that. Because the other thing that is worth pointing out as well about Bieber and Nicole is that they're black.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing I was alluding to before as to why they didn't get hardly any fucking coverage at all in the media was because of that, obviously. And the only reason that they did get any attention at all was because one of the police officers who attended the crime scene took pictures of Bieber and Nicole's bodies and posted them in a WhatsApp group chat.
Yeah.
And when that was discovered, that made the news. So the day after the killings, Danielle went to Northwick Park Hospital to get treatment for the cut on his hand. He claimed that he'd been robbed the night before and that he tried to fight off his attacker. But while Danielle was seeking help for his injuries, Bieber and Nicole's friends and family were getting increasingly worried. Also, you might have wanted to add into that contract then, Danielle, that you would win the lottery, not get suspected or arrested by the police, and not also injure yourself while you're stabbing to death multiple women. You've got to think about these things. So phone calls and text messages were unanswered for days by Nicole and Bieber. And by Sunday morning, their families were concerned enough to return to the park to find out what had happened to the two women. After a pair of sunglasses belonging to Bieber were found, her friend took them to the police station, while the others continued the search of the park for clues. Again, their families, including their boyfriends, had called the police and told them that the two women were missing, and the police didn't want to fucking know about it. They didn't care. These are two women who led, like, very low-risk lifestyles. They're not, like, transient. They're not, like, people who generally running away or anything like that. The police were just like, no, don't know. Have you tried looking for them? So the families are looking for their missing relatives in the park themselves, because even after they've been missing for days, the police don't want to know about it. So when the family are searching this park, they found a kitchen knife lying on the ground. And although the side of the blade they could see appeared to be clean, one of their friends, Adam Stone, was now terrified, and he rang the police to tell them about the discovery of the knife. While still on the phone to the emergency operator, he ran towards the trees, forced his way through the bushes, and discovered the two bodies of his best friends. It was obvious that they were dead. What you just heard was a mix of all sorts of content that we put up exclusively on Patreon. So, Under the Duvet was included in there, which is our hour-long exclusive Patreon-only podcast that we release every single Wednesday, where Hannah and I talk about everything from what's going on in global politics to the last horrible date that we went on to the latest TV show that we're watching. It's anything and everything goes. So if you're a $10 and up patron, you can actually watch that in video form every single week. Everyone else, $5 and up, can listen to the audio form of that as a podcast on the podcast player of your choice. We also release every single month our In the News segment, where we delve behind the headlines of some of the weirdest, latest true crime stories that are not quite ready for the red-handed treatment over on the main show. We also release over on Patreon for all $10 and up patrons an entire full-length bonus episode every single month. The one that we're going to be doing in the month of July is actually on the infamous Slenderman stabbings that took place in Waukesha, Wisconsin. So if you want to listen to that, head on over to Patreon now and sign up. And the really exciting thing that you should know is maybe you're like, hey, you guys have been doing Patreon for like 3 years. If I sign up now, maybe I'm too late. Maybe I missed the boat. I've missed a lot of the best content. Well, let me stop you right there. Because if you become a patron, you will actually get access to the entire back catalog. So that's right. If you sign up today to become a red-handed patron, you will get 3 years worth of bonus content. And you also, every single week, get access to that week's red-handed episode a day early and ad-free. Honestly, it's worth every penny. So go check it out. And if it takes your fancy, sign up. Thank you very much.